This is Ancient Afterlives, surprisingly modern ideas from the ancient world. This episode is presented by Simeon Whiting and Kat Gwyther, with our special guest, Dr. Joe Scales. Joined today by Joe Scales. Joe is completing his PhD at the University of Birmingham, and his research focuses on how identity is constructed in ancient communities. He's joining us today to discuss an essay he's written recently on Jewish and Greek bathing and how this affects how we understand Jewish and Hellenistic identity. I'll also embarrass Joe at this point by pointing out that this essay has won a rather prestigious prize. This is a prize run by the Palestinian Exploration Fund, and it is the rather grandly named Routledge Philip R. Davis Early Career Publication Awards. So, kudos to you, Joe. This is going to be seriously good stuff. Joe, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
It's nice to be with you.
Very much looking forward to discussing this with you. So this paper of yours focuses on a bathhouse. Is that right? Tell us more about this bathhouse. Where is it and what's unusual about it?
Sure. It's as Simeon has congratulated me on this essay. It's currently under review for publication, so hopefully it should be more accessible, and I'll do what I can to make it more widely available for readers who are interested. In this article, I discuss the so-called Magdala bathhouse, which is in a settlement, ancient settlement up in Galilee. It's thought to have been built in the Hasmonean period, so this is the late 2nd century BCE or early 1st century BCE. The settlement was quite a rich port town, so on the edge of the Sea of Galilee, just north of Tiberias, modern Tarivia. If you want to go there and look at some of the excavations, there are currently two, north and the south excavation. You can visit the north one and pay a very reasonable fee to wander around. And the bathhouse was discovered, I think, in the 1970s. There was definitely a publication which suggested that one particular feature of this bathhouse, what's now been identified as a particular type of fountain, was thought to be an ancient synagogue, because it's kind of floor plan, seemed to have benches around some of the sides, there were some columns and some other things. So this excavation kind of initially had some interest for quite a number of years, until really in the last few decades, more and more scholars and archaeologists have said, no, this structure is just a part of this bathhouse. And then the bathhouse seems to have escaped notice other than this one particular feature of it. I think this is perhaps because some of the publications around the excavations have been fairly slow in coming out in accessible volumes or places. A lot of the archaeology that comes out around Magdala is done kind of press release style. I know a few of the excavators are working on some really nice volumes that will go in a bit more depth, but it's been, as sometimes the case with archaeology, publishing results has been quite limited, so people's access to it is also going to be limited. But this bathhouse is particularly interesting because even in quite recent publications that look at Hellenistic and early Roman bathhouses, which were for the most part public institutions, you might be familiar with Roman baths. If you go to Bath, you can see some of the really fancy Roman baths and just see all the space they dedicated to this social and luxurious pastime. There's been a lot of study of bathhouses around the ancient Mediterranean, and we kind of see the early introduction of these public institutions in mainland Greece and Italy from perhaps the 5th century BCE. And scholars have kind of said that this process of building public bathhouses has taken quite a long time to make its way into the ancient Near East. So most people, if they just read textbooks on this kind of idea, would say the first public bathhouses in Palestine come from the 2nd century CE, so really when After the Wars of the Jews against Rome have finished, Hadrian builds. There's a lot of kind of cultural mix going on. The Roman Empire is perhaps at its height. So this is when we see the incorporation of these structures into kind of civic life. Now, what that then means, we have something like perhaps a 300-year gap between when scholars think or traditionally assume bathhouses entered this region and when we have documented evidence of one being built.
Okay, so this is interesting. So conventional wisdom is public bathhouses, Greco-Roman thing, so it would have been 2nd century CE. We've got this one in Magdala that's much, much earlier than that. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit of an anomaly.
Yeah, you could say that. I think everything's an anomaly until we find more of them, and you're always finding more of them in archaeology. So that's the kind of interesting thing, is it might make us reassess some of the assumptions we have about the Hasmonean state, about emerging Judaism, ancient Judaism, because as far as we can tell, this is built by Jewish authorities. It's used for a long, long time. There are at least three phases of renovations. There are a number of features in it that are quite interesting. So I've kind of examined this, and I think it, thinking along the same lines as textual scholars, scholars who work on Jewish Greek writing, we start to see that what has largely been moved away from in many areas of scholarship, this kind of binary understanding of the Hellenistic world and the Jewish world, that kind of maybe they clash, maybe they synthesize, but there's always this understanding of two, is starting to collapse in textual scholarship. And I think that same thing can be observed in archaeology and cultures being produced that kind of confounds the way we would like to put these in one or the other.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because it's really interesting that you use this as an example to kind of explore these two categories of Jewish and Hellenistic in the ancient world and kind of how scholars use them. But kind of what was it, something about scholarship or the bathhouse itself that kind of triggered that thought for you? Or yeah, just tell us a bit more how you kind of thought that the Magdala bathhouse would be a great example to kind of explore this tension that you see.
Yeah, I think it's really quite astute picking up on it. The bathhouse, initially, I can't remember quite how I came around to proposing this idea for an SBL unit, but it really did just seem that a lot of my colleagues who work in the textual stuff have been saying really interesting, insightful things about the breakdown of Hellenism and Judaism, and that we should view Jewish Greek production, so Jewish texts written in Greek, as participants in the culture of Hellenism. And when I was reading more and more about the bathhouse, it kind of touched on a little bit for my PhD, a lot of the language was very much classifying elements of it as, oh, this is clearly Roman, or this is Greek style, and this is Jewish, and it just felt like a It just took apart this wonderful, quite complex structure and assigned bits to very clear lines of cultural transmission, despite the fact this is by far and away the earliest public one we're aware of in the region. So we don't have any real good precursors around. And we're kind of still thinking on the fly. So a lot of the stuff that you might is sometimes understood to be elements of Jewish culture are lacks of things. So, for example, in many Roman-style bathhouses, we see lots of statuary. So marble statues, usually carved of gods, and mythical figures, and all these other kind of things. And around this period, we generally think that Jewish people were quite aniconistic. Essentially, they don't like images of living creatures. So when we look in the bathhouse, we don't find any traces of statues, which, to be fair, isn't that surprising, because when we look generally in the region around this time, we don't really see any traces of statues. There are some, like, around the coast where they've obviously been imported, but marble is not a native stone in these parts, so you have to import it. And what that kind of generates is we have a lack of something that we expect from a prototypical example, and we've got another example that lacks it. And then we decide that one of these is generative of a culture and the other one is receptive of the culture. So we have to interpret a Roman style with all these other features that might be even quite later than this, in a completely different region, different access to resources, different stylistic preferences. And then we decide that this isn't conforming to the first one. And then it's got to be something else. It can't be another example of Hellenistic bathing. So it's a little bit unclear there. Hopefully that kind of makes sense.
So let me see if I've understood this. So we've got this bathhouse in Magdala, and there are some features which are very clearly Greek. Now, the whole idea of public bathing is generally understood as being a Greco-Roman thing. We've got it in this apparently Jewish settlement. And there are things missing from this bathhouse. So there's no statuary, for example. And that would have been a classic Greco-Roman feature. And that's not there, which suggests that there's as much Jewish culture in this as Hellenistic. Have I understood that right?
So that's actually how most people have understood it. And I think this is making a category error, because right. We are kind of determining what we think is prototypical or an exemplar type of ancient bathing. And we've got a type that is underdocumented, underwritten about, even though it is quite unique at the moment. We haven't found many others that are of a similar age that are public bathhouses in the region. And we've decided that this one is anomalous. So instead of, let's say, redrawing the bounds of what we think ancient bathhouses in this period in the ancient Mediterranean looks like, we decide that this one is different.
Oh, okay. So I'm coming out here, so back to front.
I think you described very well, much better than I managed to, how this has usually been written about.
Right.
It's really interesting, though, kind of one of the words you were just using was non-conforming, and then you're talking about almost the stuffing into categories. Do you think that this kind of problem with categories or the categorization process is particularly inherent in discussion of the Jewish and Hellenistic world, or a problem for kind of biblical scholarship more frequently, or maybe a problem, a better way to phrase that, is a problem for scholarship of a world which we're so removed from in so many ways, is this kind of mapping on artificial categories? And almost a follow-up question is that, is this a useful exercise, or should we just kind of chuck it away and start afresh?
I think I'm going to have to turn... That's a really good question. I think I'm going to have to turn some parts of it around and see what each of you to think. I think we have to use categories in a certain way to compare things, so we might better understand them. In the ancient world, let's say we get two texts, and they both seem to be a particular type of text, they might be useful to compare to see how they approach things differently. Mm-hmm. So you might have a category by which you can compare and see how those two texts match together. I think it's very useful, and it's not something I want to completely abandon, but there is an element where you can see, I think, quite well in this case, that a predefined notion of the category has begun to overrule evidence. And when we kind of move into that stage, when the category can't change depending on new discoveries, new insights, new methods, then that category has become a fixed notion that you can't really escape from. And it feels that, you know, the world is always throwing up things that don't conform to these kind of categories. So they might be useful in some ways to work with, but they shouldn't be treated as this kind of true description of everything is this or that.
Yeah, kind of an either-or binary model is... I think maybe we should reject then.
I almost think it's quite a natural thing to do. So I'm almost quite taken with George Lakoff and Mark Johnson's stuff on bodies and categorizations. And their work kind of points out that the way we tend to systematize things around us is often based on our body lived experience. Mm-hmm. So we have a conception of ourselves as a contained unit, and then everything else is somehow outside of that. So in our very way of being in the world, we are quite binary. So we naturally want to look for these inside-outside dichotomies, because that's a lot of our lived experience. Now, I don't know whether that's entirely the case. I'm not a psychologist. But there's something quite compelling about that. And when we think, even when we're thinking about cultural definitions, identities, all these kind of things, there does seem to be a prevailing element that definitely happens in cultural formation, that there is us and them.
Yes.
There is an inner and an outer. Mm-hmm. And that kind of construction is always rhetorical, and it's always trying to make a point. And often we can make the mistake of taking that as a true description of reality, and things are always a lot more complicated than that.
We do seem to like, I suppose it's human nature, we do seem to like our nice, neatly delineated categories, don't we? We tend to be uncomfortable with ambiguity.
I think so.
And one of the points which kind of jumped off the page at me as I read your paper was the line, we must decategorize Judaism and Hellenism and reformulate how we describe ancient materials. So there's suggestions there that actually this could have fairly far-reaching consequences for really our entire approach to this kind of thing, which is important stuff, really.
I think so. I think what I'd like in some ways is to open up a little bit of discourse that we can compare things that are seemingly quite alien to one another and removed, and think about how they participate in a shared culture of the ancient world. And these games are always kind of ongoing, and what counts, not yesterday. Sorry to bring politics into this, but the impeachment trial of the former president of the United States, a large part of, or at least some of the defense lawyers' discourse was about, you know, what the Senate meant in ancient Greece and Rome, and these kind of ideas of this is true civilization, this is like an exemplar type of democracy, often is very flawed in its approach and tends to prioritize, we can compare ourselves with the Greeks, for instance, rather than a whole spate of other kinds of political arrangement. So I think there's something we like to have these binary things, because then we can map them onto our own experience as well. And in some ways, I think this is my suspicion. This is kind of like a forthcoming project. So I'm very much at the beginning of thinking about these kind of things. My suspicion is that the way scholarship has talked about, particularly Hellenism and Judaism, comes from a place of a binary opposition between Greek culture and Jewish culture, and sees the synthesis, this kind of dialectical bringing together, bear fruit in the form of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And this is always like on the edge of what moves beyond binaries, where we've got Galatians 3 and all this other kind of stuff, like no longer that. And there's this very, the construction of these two things that needed to be brought together, I think in part comes out of kind of this early kind of like modern scholarly constructions that are moving in this kind of process of history towards the inevitable fulfillment of Christianity. And there's a whole lot to unpack there.
I just kind of want to pick up on that. I think that's really fascinating. Actually, I feel like a lot of resonance with my own research in that, is that when we construct binaries, we construct us and them, we always, you say this one phrase in your thesis, and I know we've had conversations about this, but this idea that boundary marking and categorization is an act of power. And when you construct those boundaries and those identities of who's us and who's them, you're engaging in a process of othering in some way, or a marking out of who's superior. And I think that's really interesting when we're talking about kind of the synthesis of Jewish and Hellenistic being Christianity, is because it's almost that it's, maybe this isn't potentially the right way to phrase it or a dangerous way to phrase it, but that kind of supersessionist idea that kind of Christianity is this superior thing, that only when Jewish identity is combined with Hellenistic do we get this kind of nice, pure, lovely thing. I don't know if that was kind of what you meant, but that's definitely how I felt about it. And I also wondered if you could maybe speak a little bit more about the categorization process as a power process, and who has that power in this process, because actually in scholarship a lot of the time it's the scholars that have the power, not the cultures themselves. We're kind of, it's going back to the idea of artificial mapping, is that we're making those decisions about how these lived experiences were, rather than the lived experiences telling us how they lived and how they shaped their own identity.
Completely. I think that is what I was driving at. There is this supersessionist element, completely. And I think it was framed as, you know, you've got this kind of rationalism of Greek philosophers and their kind of high culture and thinking about things, and then the revelation from this other Jewish heritage. And really it seeks to kind of overturn both of them and confine both of them. And this is the expression of power. Like in any kind of categorization, you take on a role of determining what counts and what doesn't count.
Mm.
And we can't know everything. We can't kind of hold everything in our heads. We can't have this complete range that we can seamlessly transfer between, or maybe we can. It feels like there's too much out there to properly kind of grasp without having some of these shortcuts. But there's definitely an element where we see this in, I think Ivan Rocek has written about this in terms of the biblical and the non-biblical in kind of ancient biblical studies or Jewish studies. It's almost there just in the name. But there's a way which scholars and scholarship tends to approach these ancient texts, which is nominally from a standpoint of, we just want to know about ancient history, we want to know about ancient culture in some cases, and still decides that certain texts are the ones which we should read everything else in the light of. So there's this whole body of work, ancient production, that is almost treated as secondary. And this is a clear kind of expression of where power lies, not just in scholarship, but in culture. So if you want to get things funded, then you might have to pick certain things that people are going to appeal to. And there's, you know, we need to make our work appealing, but there's still this element of the things we choose to really get to know and choose the forefront and foreground in our own work are always ideological choices. And sometimes those choices can be liberating and sometimes they're not. And maintaining a lot of these kind of categories, the same we'd have in other things. So gender, for instance, maintaining these kind of the way we talk about ancient societies is patriarchal, very fair, quite often accurate, but that almost might cause us to put our own misogyny and patriarchy into texts which aren't engaging in the same kinds of discourses or associations. And we even had this, I saw this yesterday as well, a really depressing and kind of heartbreaking tweet about a Methodist bookshop where books by women were in the women's section and books by Black and Indigenous scholars were in their own kind of like almost Black studies section. And then there was just theology for all the white men who'd written books on theology. That just so neatly articulates this kind of constant second guessing and the harmful application of categories, which again, what is the exemplar we're going to take as what defines everything else? Everything else is defined according to this narrow bracket, and it doesn't have to be like that.
Last time we spoke about this, you came out with this wonderful one-liner, Joe, and you said we need to learn to be kind to our ancient people. And that really stayed with me. And for me, I took away from that, we need to come at, well, pretty much everything we research, but especially when we're sort of imposing ourselves onto an ancient community or an ancient civilization. We need to approach it with a sense of humility, I suppose, and be very aware of how much of ourselves we're kind of imposing on the top of what's there and putting something artificial on it. And that's what I took away from it. That I found that very thought-provoking.
I think so. I might, hearing it back, I might revise it a little bit and think we can extend our kindness to people we're perhaps not disposed to be kind towards, rather than how a lot of, let's say, popular history might remember people for their beneficence or, you know, giving great works to charity, but in reality were monsters. And we kind of have this weird inverse idealization of figures like Julius Caesar, who's a monster. Like, there is no kind of getting around this, but the way he's presented in a lot of history cannot help hero worship, because he did lots of very quite impressive and almost singular things. But then we also, like, the inverse of that is we have a lot of these other figures that are completely lost to history, and we just take care over this kind of wonderful opportunity to think about how ancient people lived, and not to... I had this kind of thought when I was trying to, in my thesis, define ancient Judaism, which is kind of very much beyond me still. But I had this thought that in any definition I come up with, is this going to satisfy everyone who thought this is, you know, I'm Jewish in the ancient world? And I kind of came away with probably not. So the way we talk about things is almost inevitably going to be excluding. And I think just having that kind of kindness and acceptance in many ways of ancient people's modes of thinking about themselves and of being is like almost a first step. But yeah, just maybe not kind to all of them.
I love that idea of kind of your idea when you're talking about kind of the process of categorization and coming up with an idea of what it means to be Jewish that is going to kind of satisfy all these categories. I love that almost inevitable failure of that, because I think that really demonstrates that identity is so fluid and so unfixable that when you set out on this great kind of scholarly mission to, I'm going to tell you exactly what Judaism is in these texts, or what it means to be a Jewish man or a Jewish woman, or to be part of a Jewish culture, knowing that that is a kind of a waste of time, it's not, but a failure of a of a project in itself, that I think really demonstrates how scholars can appreciate the fluidity of identity. And I think I see a lot of parallels with your work, with discussions that we're having within scholarship, but also in kind of general contemporary culture about identity with gender, and this almost failure of binaries in those categories, and how constantly now we're uncategorizing them and pulling them apart and asking, what does it mean to be a woman in kind of these texts? Are these characters fulfilling those nice neat set of boundaries? And I almost feel that the part I come away with and I feel most fulfilled by is that failure almost of those missions, because I think that it, in itself is the best image of these lives of these ancient people, is that we don't know if that.
And this is why our discourse and discipline needs to be very varied and needs to have voices from everywhere and every experience and background, because otherwise we will start to agree on certain things that match up what the academy looks like. We're all influenced and kind of limited by our own horizons, so there's, I think we need a lot of difference to break us out of certain kind of consensus that emerge around, okay, we can all agree that circumcision is probably a constituent part of ancient Judaism. And then if we just for a moment step back, and I was struck by, I think it might have been Cynthia Baker wrote about this in a really nice article. If we're defining Judaism by circumcision, we're not defining what it is to be Jewish, we're defining what it is to be a Jewish man.
Mm. Yeah.
And that just really kind of like, there's a moment you just think, that's completely right. And what do you then do with that? Because we've got something that almost time and again, texts that are Jewish and non-Jewish, like speaking from the outside, are reiterating that this is a large part of kind of self-identity and culture, but it's only applicable to half. So we kind of need this openness, and I would definitely think that the more varied voices we have working on the ancient world, the more true to life we can make our own reconstructions of history.
So I think what we're seeing here is a really interesting kind of intersection of diversity in the modern world and an awareness that actually identity can be a bit of a slippery thing, and you can't split it into these neat categories. Kind of meeting this research that you and some others are doing, which is throwing into question some of these neatly defined categories we had previously assumed are applicable to the study of the ancient world. So if we bring a diversity of thought from the modern world into this arena where we've got, you know, starting to question some of these assumptions we've made about categories, then we could get some really fruitful research and some really challenging ideas coming out of it.
Yeah. I think the future challenge is just to make this more widely known, and hopefully something like Ancient Afterlives will achieve that in a
small way. Well, I hope so, yeah.
But you can see disciplines struggling with this, struggling with what do we do with kind of a legacy that has been very harmful in a discipline. So in our own, we could take as the case study supersessionist claims been made kind of around Judaism, and Judaism being used as kind of like a negative foil for Christianity. What did we do when so much of our bedrock is built on that? And I've seen a lot of stuff around, you know, burn it all down, start over. I forget exactly who it is, but it's a wonderful quote. You know, the master's tools will never dismantle
Audre
the master's
Lorde.
House.
I'm pretty sure it's Audre Lorde.
Thank you. And that, I don't know what to do with all that. Again, I think it's just more, again, pressing challenges to rethink the way we do things, the way we put things in the ancient world, but then also the way we construct our own approach to scholarship and what it means to be a scholarly rigorous, or what it means to be critical, or even, you know, philology or archaeology. And all of these kind of disciplines have hidden histories. Mm-hmm. And kind of the rules of how you do it are often fairly arbitrary to one degree or another. So I don't know. I'm hoping some of my work and like a lot of my friends' work and both of your work takes up these kind of like challenges of rethinking about method and what we're doing and how this is relevant.
Mm.
I think we're seeing more of it. It's just quite occasionally disheartening when there is the inevitable backlash against these kind of moves. And I think that's just, if you're shaking foundations, then people who have built a lot on that are going to be worried. But ultimately, we're all interested, hopefully, in the same kind of things. And this is why we all talk to one another, because we want to know more about the ancient world. We want to know more about ourselves. I think that's just what we've got to do.
Yeah, well, one thing I feel like I've learned from other disciplines, not necessarily ours, is this kind of idea of positionality. And it's so wonderfully talked about in kind of feminist sociology and kind of feminist philosophies of this, how do I approach this, and what position am I coming in, what are kind of the ideologies inherent in this positionality. And I think that's something that disciplines outside of biblical studies and ancient recent studies, ancient Jewish studies, have picked up and successfully, maybe the success can be kind of determined. I don't want to claim it's a massive success, but they picked it up and kind of started to integrate that. And I think there's almost an idea in our disciplines that we can kind of approach these texts objectively, or we can have like a scientific method where we can just view the text and see what they're saying without kind of acknowledging that the people that are doing them, us, have our own viewpoints, our own commitments, our own backgrounds that are inevitably going to influence however we read kind of whatever archaeological data, how we read text, even kind of the words that are emphasized to us in a reading of a verse. There, I think, actually that's pointed out by what me and Simeon have been kind of talking about your work, Joe, is that we've both picked out really different things from your work. Mm. But that's reflective of how we have read it and understood it, and the parts that we've taken away to digest because of our own research interests, our own kind of personal commitments. And I think an understanding of positions as scholars as more than kind of these godlike figures that are kind of immutable or removed from culture, I think is almost an approach we need to start thinking about and start rigorously engaging with. I wonder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anything to add, Simi?
I just thought it would be helpful as we come towards the end of our time together. We just pin down one or two ideas about how some of your research and some of your ideas might be applicable to the world we live in now. So some of the, are there categories we need to challenge maybe? Are there areas where we might be imposing identity on other people or assuming things about other people's identity? Are there places where, categories are being challenged and we need to be open to understanding ourselves and understanding our own identity in a different way, maybe?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure I've got really much to say on it. I think a lot of people who are working on intersectionality and kind of this post-colonial stuff, I think they've got a much better handle than I do of things we need to reevaluate.
I could see Kat getting excited about this one.
I mean, Kat can answer for me.
I see a lot of echoes in the very kind of process of what you're trying to do and kind of bring into question the binary of, and definitely the binary opposition of Jewish and Hellenistic, as I see a lot of echoes of that in gender and gendered approaches to the Bible, or particularly ones that are looking for non-binary characters or trans interpretations, or ones that kind of gender fuck is a great phrase used by Darren Guest, and that kind of, why are we seeing man and woman as these two kind of opposed things when they don't actually appear to that in our everyday lives? To kind of like, our definitions of masculinity and femininity are often quite blurred and jar with each other, but in ancient texts they do the exact same. What it means to be a man in the biblical texts often isn't always fulfilled to kind of perfection, and actually there are a lot of discussions of what it means to be a woman in, alongside what it means to be a man, and characters in the ancient world. I think of some friend's work that's just excellent about kind of bringing into question how characters don't always fulfill what it means to be a woman, but are constantly ascribed that category because of our assumptions and don't necessarily have a holistic reading of what that character is and who that character is in the text. Jael from Judges 4-5 comes immediately to mind. I've got a very good friend. She's just written her thesis on that. And I think I see the kind of the process of what you're doing is also happening, discussions of gender in the ancient world and discussions of gender in the biblical text, but also discussions of gender today. We're kind of more and more we're questioning, do these categories work? Do they work as categories in themselves, but also do they work as categories that can be then be mapped onto lived experience? And I think the answer that we're gradually getting to is no. I'm not sure that anyone's got an answer of where we go from here, but I think actually getting towards that step of, oh, I'm not sure these work, is useful enough.
So I was always hesitant to say really what my work affects, because I think my work is drawn from discussions like this. And it's not that I'm trying to say something new to them, but this is the way my mind has gone thinking about the ancient world by listening to people talk about race in a modern world, or talk about gender identity, or talk about kind of class and these kind of effects. So I think that's the stuff that is affecting, and it's like these discussions of modern culture are what is affecting my own reading of the ancient world, and that's how it always has been. So yeah, I don't know, hopefully some of this is generative, and I feel like I'm just kind of passing on those kind of insights into our own little discipline, hoping that generates a bit more. But I am completely indebted to that kind of work. People, you know, even mostly small things on Twitter, they tend to just make me think, and they kind of show you how to think in a slightly different way if you've got quite a varied Twitter feed.
I think it's really important as well to see your work as kind of a bigger process. I think I've said this quite a bit throughout this chat, is a bigger process of questioning categories that we're having. I can think of people's work in kind of like generic categories of, what does it mean for a text to be X? There are questions about that. What does it mean to be a woman in the biblical text? There are questions that are happening about that. What does it mean to be Jewish? What does it mean to be Hellenistic? Those questions, I think they're all very different questions and often happen in very different circles in our discipline, but I think ultimately they are all connected with this kind of critical analysis of how we're going about our study and how we're going about orientating ourselves in these ancient texts. So I think that's, to me, what kind of, when I was reading your work, that's where I really found myself kind of being like, oh, that's really interesting, that fits with this. And yeah.
Thank you.
Brilliant. Well, I think this is a really exciting piece of research. I can't wait to see it, you know, properly in print. I'm also very much looking forward to giving your thesis a proper read. I've read a couple of chapters, but not the whole
thank
thing.
You.
Joe, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Ancient Afterlives. If you'd like to contact us, you can email ancientafterlives@gmail.com or find us on Twitter. Thanks for listening.